I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad.
What if what we call public opinion was just a manufactured narrative that makes it easier to convince people that if their views are different, then there's something wrong with that, or there's something wrong with them?
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
Please shut down the system.
And now for Newsreel. This is your host, Maltos.
It is a good day. This is Mike reporting to you from the internet for Sunday, January the 25th, 2015. You are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global sit-rep on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening in and distributing this program, you are too. You can follow along with our news stories and check the facts by going to newsreel.ca. This is a free podcast that can be heard on Rant Radio Talk each and every Sunday afternoon at 1400 hours or 2 p.m. Pacific time. Yeah, a little bit of news for Newsreel itself, for this show, and I guess for myself, is that being the 25th of January, I was actually laid off my job about 6 days ago. So I've been packing up the apartment and I'm actually heading back to Ontario until I can find new work. Yay. Kind of a crappy situation, but whatever. So just a bit of a heads up for all the loyal listeners out there. This show may be put on hiatus during the next few months. It may not be. I'm not sure what's going on. The place where I'm going to, I'm not going to give names or anything like that, whose place I'm going to, because it's really not nobody's business. But place I'm going to, the internet connection is kind of eh. It's decent, but it's not a lot of bandwidth. I think it's like 30 gigs a month, which is not a lot, because I usually go through about 36, 37, I guess, what I've seen the last 7.5 months of working here in Regina. That's like a normal load. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. But not too worried about it. But it's not just the internet connection. The internet connection is not really a big deal. These shows aren't that long, or I mean, aren't that bandwidth heavy, I guess, really. But the big thing is just kind of privacy when I'm recording, and noise and stuff. I mean, it's bad enough having noise in this apartment with people walking around in the apartment above me, and people running around the hallways outside and cars going by. You think a sealed house, a sealed apartment building like this wouldn't have as much noise from the road being about 100 meters away, 50 meters away. I don't know how far away that is. Maybe it's only 25 meters. I don't know. It's about 100 feet away. And it's still a lot of freaking noise coming off that sometimes. But despite all that, I can kind of minimize that a bit. But where I'm going to be going, it's a little bit, I don't know. It's, the noises are a bit more random. And, yeah, I don't know. I think interruptions are going to be a big pain in the ass, too. So, I'm not sure what's going to go on with that. This could keep going. It might not. I'm not giving up on Newsreel. I will continue on with it one way or another. Maybe I'll have to go out in the woods with my tablet and record on my tablet. Or on my phone, even. Oh, excuse me. Maybe I'll have to do that just so I can kind of get rid of some of that noise. And I can do noise cancellation on that a little bit better. Because outside's a little bit more, I don't know, out in the woods is a little bit more predictable noise-wise than being in a house. You know, have a vacuum cleaner randomly fire up or something stupid like that, which I can't compensate for. So hopefully I'll keep going. If I don't worry, it will be back one way or another. It might be on a reduced schedule, maybe a few times a month as opposed to the regular 3 to 4 times a month. I'm hoping not, because then that'd be like a 5 hour long show, but whatever. So just a heads up, and keep sending news stories and stuff in just in case, because I'm gonna try it next week. After I get set up, where I'm going to be going to Ontario there, and I'm going to, I'm just gonna see what the situation's like. Hopefully, it's favorable for the show. Hopefully, it's a little bit more favorable than this. Hopefully, there's gonna be a lot less echo, so I don't have to worry, freak out over that too much anymore. Anyways, that's just that. Oh, and also, if anybody knows of any jobs, hey, whatever. You want to know what my qualifications are, you can find me on LinkedIn or whatever. Anyways, also, don't pay for that service, because I've never have and I never will. But, it's a waste of money. Anyways, into the regular news. In Black Shakes News, thanks to Weandy for this one. This is like the Weandy and Exec show today. By the way, everything's staggered. It's Weandy Exec, Weandy Exec, Weandy Exec, all the way down. But anyways, in Black Shakes News, zero stroke was a mental illness that affected an entire country. This is from, what the hell is this website? IO9, I guess. This is from the 16th of this month. Have you spent a day busily procrastinating by playing Tetris? Haven't we all? Gone to bed and dreamed of playing Tetris? If so, you might just have the faint echo of a mental affliction that German people suffered just after World War I. It's called Zero Stroke. Of course, because we're going to give an awesome name. Imagine that you're compelled to engage in a certain repetitive mental activity. Even when you're not actively forced to make a certain calculation, you're always, always thinking about it. How would that eventually affect you? If you answered negatively, you're beginning to understand what happened to people, of Germany just after World War I. The economy was in ruins, and inflation was climbing so fast that the cost of a loaf of bread was first measured in thousands of marks, then millions, and then billions. That's quite a bit of inflation, holy crap. There was no way to keep up with... There was no way to keep up with the rising cost of living, but people were forced to try. That meant that they had to multiply millions to pay for the basics of a meal. It meant that even when they weren't actively calculating, they had to plan, figuring out the value of what they had and extrapolating what it would buy them tomorrow, and the next day, and the next. This frantic mental activity that never ended left many people with a condition called zero stroke. Sufferers of zero stroke dreamt of calculating numbers. When they were awake, they would constantly write strings of zeros or strings of numbers. This was kind of before computers and stuff, so maybe, I don't know, maybe just writing a 1 and a whole bunch of, I don't know, whatever. Or strings of numbers, or try to make complex calculations. The inflation made it into their head, and they couldn't stop thinking in large numbers, telling people that they had millions of children or were billions of years old. Mentally, they were trying to work their way out of a tough situation with obsessive calculation, literally. So that's very interesting that actually happened. I think I've actually had this. This is like the playing the, if you play the video game. I know it says playing Tetris, but we had a news show back when Gatekeeper was still on as a host, about playing video games and that it conditioned you, or I don't know, or something like that. That was a long time ago, that story. But same thing, like you go to bed and you still dream like you're fighting and stuff. It's like me when I did, when I was in college and doing my GIS work, in one of the GIS courses I had to do. And this thing called generalization, where you have the outline of a country or a province or something like that, and the little areas around the border, or around the outside edge of the whatever the heck it is, the shape that you're working with. If you zoom out a certain level, your scale, if you're zoomed in, it's not so bad. You can see all the detail, but if you leave all that detail there and you zoom out, all that detail turns into black blobs or whatever color you have your border at. It turns into blobs and you can't really see the detail. It just looks like a whole bunch of, because the lines are all so close to each other because it just shrunk. So you have to go through and generalize that, which is removing some of that detail so that it looks better when it's far away. And there's ways to do it, to automate it and stuff. And I personally prefer to do it manually because I'm badass like that. And it takes to do an entire shapefile of the the boundaries of Canada, like the national boundaries. It took me about 3 or 4 days, and that's like 4 to 8 hours a day. So it's a lot of clicking and stuff. And in a program I use, ArcGIS, you have to, you go in and you edit it, and it turns, it shows you all the, where the line goes from one direction to the other. So where the vertices are. So if you have a curve, it's not really a curve, it's like multiple straight lines attached to each other, just angled a little bit differently when you zoom in and stuff. So anyways, to generalize, you have to kill some of these vertices or these vertexes or whatever. So you go through it and you do that enough and all these little points and stuff, and I was actually going to bed and actually doing this crap in my sleep. It was horrible. But yeah, same thing. Holy crap. I don't miss those days. That was just ugh. But anyways, it's a good story there. In comms news, thank you to Exec for this one. SpaceX to build 4,000 broadband satellites in Seattle. Paris. Elon Musk, whatever your name is, Mr. Musk, on January 16th said SpaceX has submitted to international regulators the necessary documentation for a global satellite internet project to eventually include some 4,000 satellites in low Earth orbit, LEO, and initial service within 5 years. He also said Hawthorne, California-based SpaceX would not be pursuing a stock market listing for many years given the volatility of the launch services market. Musk did not provide a name for his satellite project. Click on the link there. And there was no immediate way to verify that he or SpaceX have submitted to the International Telecommunications ITU, the Geneva-based United Nations, United Nations agency that regulates orbital slots and radio spectrum. That's a United Nations setup? Okay. That's kind of scary. Also unclear is what radio frequencies the SpaceX network would use to deliver broadband from low Earth orbit. Quote, there's multiple elements to the regulatory things, unquote, Musk said in answer to a question during an invitation-only speech in Seattle announcing the creation of the SpaceX satellite factory there. Hey, if anybody wants to go into satellite building for their career, you know, hey, move to Seattle. You might have some positions open. There's the ITU filings, and we've done the filings associated with that. And there's a video there, which probably is what we just went over. The ITU operates on a first-come, first-served basis, meaning any satellite system that had registered to use the same frequencies before SpaceX made its filings would have priority over SpaceX. Depending on the frequency selected, the global network in LEO, Musk said his constellation would be at an altitude of around 1,100, that's 1,100 kilometers, would need to avoid interfering with signals from satellites in higher geostationary orbit, 36,000 kilometers over the equator. Musk's announcement came just 2 days after OneWeb LLC, formerly called WorldView Satellites, announced that Virgin Galactic of London and Qualcomm Incorporated of San Diego had agreed to invest in OneWeb's 650 satellite system. Is that the name of it, or is that it has 650 satellites? I don't know. Under the name WorldView, OneWeb has secured ITU authorization for a Q-band network, click on the link there, at 1,200 kilometers in altitude within service deadlines in 2018 and 2020. So I guess that means it'll be operational by 2018-2020 is what their deadline is. OneWeb, based in Britain's Channel Islands, will need to avoid the large number of Ku-band telecom satellites operating in higher orbit, and will be particularly challenged to operate around the equator given that most Ku-band satellites are in geostationary orbit. Musk said SpaceX is entering the satellite production business with a new plant based in Seattle, in part because there's more money associated with satellite manufacturing than with space launch services. I need to have a drink here. So it all dried up pretty quick today for some reason. Alright, sorry about that, folks. Quote, this is intended to be a significant amount of revenue and to help fund a city on Mars. Okay, that's kind of a random thing to say, but okay. Awesome. At least he's got some goals. Musk said, looking at the long term, what is needed to create a city on Mars? Well, one thing's for sure, a lot of money. Yeah. And it takes a lot of money just to get there. So anything else would be even more money. So we need things that will generate a lot of money. The SpaceX satellites are expected to weigh several hundred kilograms at launch and to use Hall effect ion electric thrusters for in-orbit maneuvering. So I'm assuming that these are not the standard micro satellites, cube satellites or whatever that are small that we've been hearing about for internet or space-based internet for the last few months or last year or so. This is probably seems like a large satellite because several hundred kilograms is pretty heavy. He said SpaceX's satellite plant would be building its own thrusters, which he characterized as a tech that can be mastered with relative ease. The SpaceX network would feature user terminals fitted with phased array antennas, inexpensive enough, for about $100 to $300, to be purchased the world over to deliver broadband to areas that are unlikely to be served by terrestrial broadband anytime soon. It should take about 5 years to build and launch an initial constellation that would cover the globe except the polar region. Course, why would you need to have the polar region covered? There's not much going on there. Or is there? We're really talking about something which is in the long term like rebuilding the internet in space. Well, it's not like rebuilding the internet space. It essentially is rebuilding the internet in space. Or at least the infrastructure anyways. Musk said, or the transmission infrastructure, I should say. Musk said the goal will be to have the majority of long-distance internet traffic go over his network, or sorry, over this network, and about 10% of local consumer and business traffic. So 90% of people's local access will still come from fiber, but will do about 10% business to consumers directly, and more than half of the long-distance traffic. No SpaceX IPO before Mars. Musk said his experience as chairman of electric-powered automobile manufacturer Tesla Motors Incorporated of Palo Alto, California, whose stock trades on the U.S. NASDAQ market, has taught him a lesson about the fickleness of investors. With Tesla in any given week, it's like dealing with a manic depressive, Musk said of the auto company's roller coaster stock price. I think we won't take SpaceX public for quite a long time, Musk said. When we're doing regular flights to Mars, that might be a good time to go public, but before then, because the long-term goals of SpaceX are really long-term, it takes a long time to build a city on Mars, that doesn't match with the short-term time frame of public shareholders and equity managers. And yeah, like, why would you, you know, it's a train going by, I can hear. Why would you go and, you want to get the stuff going properly, keep it private until you reach your goal. Once you reach your goal, then set it public. That makes a lot of sense because I want to build a city on Mars. Okay, then you go public before that happens, and then the stockholder's like, well, I don't know, it's kind of a far-fetched idea. We don't know, blah, 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 blah. You know, just think how far, there's a whole corporate, anti-corporate stuff, obviously, that we talk about here and whatnot. But just imagine the tech that we would have if things were allowed to continue on, you know, with, you know, privately or whatever. And not, oh, that's bad because all the weapons tech and all the blah 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 and secrets and all that. The least that for something like this, you know, space travel, we should really have space travel by now. We should have flying cars by now. All this stuff. So I don't know. Maybe SpaceX should get into flying cars. They could do it. They could definitely do it. They got the money. So whatever. Random sidetrack. That said, we do offer stock options and restricted stock, and we do liquidity events every 6 months. So we have the company valued by an outside firm every 6 months, and we do stock buybacks every 6 months. It gets the best of both worlds, where you have stock liquidity, but you don't have massive fluctuations that you have for the public company. We'll go public maybe 20 years from now, or something like that. And yeah, so that's very cool. Another internet satellite. What's the word I'm looking for here? Prospect, I guess. Very, very cool. So we're going to go on to the next story in privacy news. Thank you to WeOndy for this one. This is from the Daily Tech website. Police are using new handheld radar sensors to peer into houses without warrants, I guess. Big Brother is watching you in your home.
Really?
No, really. A report in USA Today, click on the link there, sheds light on an outlandish and intrusive new form of police state spying on Americans, and quite possibly not just Americans. First, imagine, if you will, that police can see inside of your home, count how many people are inside, see where they are even. Now imagine certain federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies are engaging in this kind of snooping on a weekly basis, without warrant and with little in the way of oversight to prevent abuse. Is that a one? Okay, yeah, it is a one. Okay. One, he sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, and he's probably not Santa Claus. It sounds like the plot of a dystopian novel. Too impossible to be true, surely. But thanks to modern tech, or more specifically, a special radar device produced by L3 Communications Holdings Incorporated, LLL, I guess that's their stock symbol, reality has once more become the stuff of fiction. So that is a very sexy looking device, I must say. The Range R is a military-grade device that can spot people through solid walls. Yeah. L3 Comms is a military contractor, of course, offering combat-grade solutions to the U.S. Armed Forces and their conflict overseas. But as the increasingly militarized American police state turns its focus homeward, there's three different links here, I guess. Click on those. L3 is looking to offer up these military-grade solutions as tools for police. For policing the home front. Sorry. Wow. Man. I gotta get more water here. But not yet. This story is important. Among the military-grade solutions offered is the Range R. Click on the link there. Radar system produced by L3 subsidiary Cyterra. The device debuted a little over 2 years ago and vaguely resembles a stud finder at first glance. A military stud finder. But according to experts, this is no ordinary tool. The Range R is capable of beaming radio waves through most thin brick or concrete walls. The signals bounce off of solid objects, including people, yes, because it's radar. When that object moves, the waves are compressed or expanded, a phenomenon known as the Doppler effect. Click on the link there if you do not know what that is. Same thing that happens when you're driving around in an ambulance and the noise changes. By carefully watching the reflections for Doppler shifts, the finely tuned sensor can detect people from up to 50 feet away. That's pretty good. Sensor is so sensitive that can even detect stationary targets' slightest motions from breathing. Wow, okay, so you can tell if somebody's alive or not. Interesting. 2. From the battlefield to the police state's war on Americans. The radar was first used on battlefields in the Middle East, including Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, because that's where all the big battles have happened, really. Where soldiers used it to detect the positions of enemy insurgents that could be targeted with conventional arms or ranged support death strikes. Click on the link there. The tech was first... I already read that. Okay, with deadly accuracy. Cyterra L3 reportedly began selling the device to federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies roughly 2 years ago. With nary a clear public notice, over 50 law enforcement agencies have purchased over 200 of the devices, which retail for $6,000 US. Holy crap, that's a lot of money. That indicates Cyterra has earned over 1.2 million US in taxpayer-paid revenue for the devices. Among the larger agencies to embrace the device include the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, that's the FBI, and the U.S. Marshals Service. The latter agency has spent more than an estimated $180,000 US to purchase more than 30 of the scanners for its agents. What's more is that Cyterra is also selling smaller unknown quantities of more advanced brethren of the Range R. One such device mounts to a drone, hate that word, UAV, to scan for motion overhead. It's scanning overhead of the drone, or it's overhead, it's scanning you. Another can produce high fidelity 3D maps of buildings and the people inside of them. And that's the image of how it works, I guess, at least, blah, blah, blah. Whatever, how the sensor works. Police with radar on the outside of the building. Do-do-do-do, this person on the inside, possibly a suspect. It says suspect, but probably not. The thing bounces back. That's pretty much what it does. The waves hit something, they bounce back. It figures if it's a person or if it's a wall or whatever. More advanced sister devices can generate complex... I already read that part. I don't know why they always put these friggin' captions under the things that you just read. Of course, in some cases, the device, as Orwellian as it may seem, may be a perfectly valid tool and may even save lives. After all, police officers can, with warrant, emphasis on that, with warrant, break down a suspect's door and search a house. So if they have a warrant, example in a hostage situation, there should be few legal or constitutional issues with using such a device. In fact, they may be highly beneficial, something even most civil liberties experts agree on. I'm not reading properly. I think it's because the microphone's in front of my face today and it's just killing my field of view. The problematic nature of these purchases is mostly in the lack of transparency and the fact that in many cases they're being used without warrant. Yeah. The concern is that officers may use the devices in a clandestine manner to circumvent the need for a search warrant. That's how you're going to tell if they're using it. It's radar waves. You can't see them. Yeah, sure as hell can't feel them. You know, and 50 feet away, you could be standing across the street in another, you know, yeah, you could be standing across the street or you could be in a cop car driving by, you know, beaming this thing towards somebody's house, right? You're not going to know. And where do I leave with that? The concern is that officers in a clandestine manner, yes, I read that. Further on top of the potential constitutional issues presented by such warrantless search allowances, the lack of record keeping and transparency opens the door to even more egregious abuses, such as an officer abusing one of the devices to monitor and stalk an ex-lover. Yes, or anybody else really for that matter. See, what they should do is they should put a GPS unit in these things, mandatory, which you cannot disable, and there should be a logging system. So you turn the unit on, it has to get a GPS fix first, and then it logs it so that you bring it back and, oh, well, we think that, you know, Officer Bob over there might have been using this system or whatever, blah, 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 blah. Okay, you fire it up and check the database, and it says, oh, the logs or whatever, and so, oh, yeah. This unit was turned on at this date, this time, and at this location for this amount of time. There was no warrant for that or whatever, so Officer Bob, you're going to be disciplined. Preferably you are put on leave without pay because of that. You know, because, you know, if you're on leave, you should not be getting paid for that stuff. 3. Constitutional restrictions appear to be ignored. The Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution states, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue. But upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So, hey, you need a warrant. Clearly, the range our scanner constitutes a search of one's house. So under the Fourth Amendment, it seems clear that a search warrant should be necessary to use the device. A picture there of a Ranger device being held up to a wall like a stud finder to spy on the occupants inside. Unfortunately, there's been at least a handful of incidents where officers are clearly not following that approach. In one case in Kansas, a suspect on probation for an armed robbery offense stopped reporting to their probation officer, which, you know, that happens. Officers went to a home in Wichita, Kansas, where the suspect, Stephen Denson, was believed to be hiding out at. Using the range R without warrant, they detected that a person was inside and used that probable cause to invade the house without a search warrant. Inside, they found Mr. Denson and firearms. He was charged for probation violations over his failure to report to his officer and for being a felon in possession of firearms. Now, I have to say, something like that, you're in crap for, what was he on? Armed robbery. So you rob the place at gunpoint. Whether you got the money or not, it's armed robbery. Or attempt, or whatever. Armed robbery, you went somewhere with a weapon to do something, to steal something. So you get busted for that. And you go to jail. And then you get probation. Or prison or whatever. And then you get probation. And okay, well, part of your probation is that you have to report to local law enforcement or whatever you have to report to. If you do not do that, then essentially your rights are waived, in my opinion, because you committed a crime that with a potential to be violent, you know, armed robbery, you know, you kind of doing it with, I have this gun or this baseball bat or whatever, you know, if you do not give me what I want, I'm going to smash you in the face, or I'm going to shoot you in the face. So essentially, once you do that, once you go to jail, once you're on probation, if you do not, you know, report to your probation officer or whatever, then I think that you pretty much waived your rights. So in that situation, I can understand that. Because he's going obviously against the law. Well, yeah, yes, he went against the law. He's doing something that he's refusing. I've got the verbal diarrhea going on right now. He's refusing to do what he's supposed to do. One of his conditions for being, you know, essentially free or on probation. So, you know, I think that he'll, if he's not reporting to the probation officer, let's find him. Let's hunt him down. Let's put him back in jail or prison or wherever. I think that's a reasonable use for this. Oh, we need a warrant. I don't think you need a warrant for that. I think you have just cause, just because he's not reporting to his probation officer. And for the crime, if he like stole a car or stole a banana from a store and he got probation because of that and all that stuff, blah, 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 blah. That's a little bit different, but this is like armed robbery. So that's, you know, probable cause, just cause, whatever. He was charged for probation violations over his failure to report to his officer and for being a felon in possession of firearms. Oh, yeah, okay, firearms too. Court cases document that law enforcement agencies are using the radar without warrant to monitor. Okay. And gain probable cause to commit home violations. Or home invasions, I should say, not violations. The case last hit the November... Oh, man. The case last hit the Denver, Colorado-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. Click on the link there, where a three-judge panel acknowledged in the ruling that the range are always used to spot a person inside the home without warrant and justify a warrantless home invasion by officers. The justice is right. Click on the link there. PDF. The government's warrantless use of such a powerful tool to search inside homes poses grave Fourth Amendment questions. Yet they declined to invalidate the search in this case, as the officers also documented and presented other signs that indicated that the suspect might have been holed up in his home, offering alternative justifications for the search. The judges wrote, "We simply aren't in a position to say that the radar search negated the officer's otherwise specific and articulable," wow, big word, "reasons to worry about a compatriot lurking." Okay, there's a period there. Okay, lurking inside. "We don't doubt for a moment that the rise of increasingly sophisticated and invasive search tech will invite us to venture down this way again and soon. We don't doubt that the use of such devices could well wind up undoing the justification for a good number of protective sweeps in the future, but we lack enough information to reach that result in this case. Thus, the issue was punted for another day." But again, I think it's like, well, if the guy stole a banana and went to jail and now he's on probation because of that and he didn't report, well, that's fine because it's not a violent thing if I just, you know, pocketed a banana in the grocery store. But armed robbery of that same grocery store is a little bit different, you know, where you're taking it and you're taking it at gunpoint and, you know, you're threatening lives, right? So I think in this case, the police were justified by in any normal other circumstance, or if there's no circumstance, they're just running up the street, driving up the street with this thing shooting in the houses and pinging people, then that's definitely a violation of privacy. 4. Abuse of high-tech police tactics are on the rise. Yeah, no doubt. While that case is unlikely to see higher appeals, others likely will, and it seems probable that the Supreme Court of the U.S., SCOTUS, will eventually be able to force on warrantless use of the radar devices. It seems highly probable that the current SCOTUS panel would rule against this form of surveillance without warrant, given that in 2001 they applied strict restrictions to use of thermal imaging sensors, explicitly noting that the ruling would likely be applicable to radar motion sensors, which they accurately predicted would come into law enforcement use in the future. Look, there we are. Because that's the Supreme Court picture there. Other salient rulings include a January 2012 ruling that that barred police, click on a link there. There's a whole bunch of links in this paragraph, so just click on them all. That barred police from invading a person's property to plant GPS tracking devices. a March 2013 ruling that limited the ability of police to use warrantless drug sniffing dog searches in a person's home, and a June 2014 ruling that barred police from most warrantless cell phone searches. In the 2013 drug sniffing dog case, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote, "The right of a man to retreat into his own home and there be free from unreasonable governmental intrusion." Clearly, the SCOTUS isn't a fan of intrusive warrantless searches of private property, even in this age of digital conveniences and tools. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, who has scored many of these SCOTUS victories to beat back warrantless police surveillance, is keenly watching the issue of radar scanners and is looking for cases to bring the issue to the nation's highest court. The ACLU's The ACLU's chief technologist, Christopher told USA Today, "The idea that the U.S. government, that the government can send signals to the wall of your house to figure out what's inside is problematic. Tech that allows the police to look inside of a home are among the intrusive tools that police have." The ACLU also suggests that law enforcement agencies have gone to great lengths to obfuscate their use of these kinds of tech from the public, or to hide their use of these kinds of tech from the public. They point to a series of incriminating emails, click on the link there, with a PDF, obtained via a lawsuit against the Sarasota, Florida police. In one email, a police sergeant says that the U.S. Marshals have advised the department not to reveal how it obtained tracking information when it used a kind of cell phone-based location tracking tool called the Stingray, which is a cell phone tower spoofer, which we talked about in the last episode, I believe, or two episodes ago. They wrote, "In the past, and at the request of the U.S. Marshals, the investigative means utilized to locate the suspect have not been revealed. Instead, it was said that the information came from a confidential source." Okay, which is definitely lying. It's not a confidential source, it's equipment, it's not a person. Former U.S. Marshals Supervisor William Sirikas acknowledged that the agency often looks to keep quiet the high-tech surveillance tools it uses with and without warrant, but he insists this isn't an effort to deceive the public, but rather a tactic used to keep criminals unaware of the capabilities of law enforcement. He comments, "If you disclose a tech or a method or a source, you're telling the bad guys along with everyone else." Yeah, I do agree with that. Again, to an extent, as long as it's being used properly, it's fine. If it's being, you know, misused, mistreated, and like in the last episode with those stingrays, they're grabbing information from everybody. So I can understand that if they keep that information for a little bit of time and they have to analyze it, fine. But after a certain period of time, if it's not useful information, they dispose of it. They kill it. The ACLU and other groups see things differently, viewing such tactics as unethical. How long is this freaking story? Okay, it's almost done. Holy crap. I think it's just the pictures that are driving me up the wall. Viewing such tactics as unethical approaches that criminalize the average law-abiding American. And they say such secrecy not only opens the door to furtive federal abuse, but that there is a clear track record of such unlawful abuses. The ACLU, for example, has accused the Obama administration of trying to brazenly defy the SCOTUS prohibitions on warrantless GPS tracking and phone searches. Click on the link there. It alleges that federal law enforcement agencies continue to use the now illegal tactics, looking to disguise the use by declining to mention how they discovered certain forms of data. "Oh, how'd you grab that form of data, Officer Bob?" It's confidential source. We can't discuss it for the safety of the source and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay. He's lying. 5. Coming soon to a Supreme Court near you, after I spit on my microphone all over the place. To a Supreme Court near you if you're in Washington, D.C. Haney Fakhouri, sorry about your name, guy. Probably screwed that up. A lawyer from the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, another digital civil liberties advocacy, emphasized that the point of contention was the lack of transparency and potential warrantless use. They state, "The problem isn't that the police have this. The issue isn't the tech. The issue is always about how you use it and what the safeguards are." Eventually, the EFF, ACLU, and other groups will likely push the issue up to the Supreme Court. and assume the high court rules against warrantless use, that will give civil liberties advocates a powerful footing to track and strike down unlawful use. Until that happens, though, Americans will have to live with the uncomfortable knowledge that hundreds of military-grade tracking devices are being used to peer through the walls of private residences, often without warrant, and with the government going to lengths, I'd say even great lengths, to obfuscate or to hide these actions. That's very interesting. So, I'm not going to give any more points on that. I've already done it. So, in Aliens, What Aliens News? Thank you to Exec for this one. CIA about UFOs of the 1950s and 60s. It was us. Insert picture of the U-2 spy plane. High-flying U-2 spy plane stirred up UFO reports, claims the CIA. Many of the unidentified flying objects, or UFOs, spotted by people in the middle of the last century were actually high-flying spy planes, officials from the US CIA said. On December 29th, CIA officials said the following via Twitter. Number one most read on our best of 2014 list, reports of unusual activity in the skies of the 50s. It was us. Attached to the tweet was a PDF of the CIA and the U-2 program, 1954 to 1974, a report about the United States manned U-2 spy plane written by agency historians and published in 98. The document notes that high altitude testing of the U-2 soon led to an unexpected side effect, a tremendous increase in reports of unidentified flying objects. In the mid-50s, most commercial airliners flew at altitudes between 10 and 20,000 feet. But once U-2 started, so that's about 3 to 6 kilometers up. But once U-2 started flying at much higher altitudes, above 60,000 feet, so that's about 18, almost 18 and a half kilometers, air traffic controllers began receiving increasing numbers of UFO reports, the report explains. The A-12 aircraft, that's the forerunner to the SR-71, I believe. Airline pilots also, so yeah, random picture there of another spy plane. Airline pilots who wrote letters to the Air Force unit at Wright Air Development Command in Dayton, Ohio, a group charged with investigating UFO phenomena. Quote, this in turn led to the Air Force's Operation Blue Book, based at Wright-Patterson. The operation collected all reports of UFO sightings, the document states. Blue Book officials regularly called on the CIA to help investigators eliminate the majority of UFO reports, the document explains, although they could not reveal to the letter writers the true cause of the UFO sightings. Claims court, the CIA tweet has sparked its own UFO flap. Several analysts dispute the CIA assertion that U-2 flights really cause upward of half of all UFO sightings. One thing the CIA UFO claim has accomplished, it has united UFO skeptics and proponents in proclaiming that it is untrue. Robert Schaefer, author and well-known UFO cynic, wrote in a blog post last week, click on the link there, we might agree on little else except that this claim is nonsense. Schaefer explains the Project Blue Book files are now public records, allowing anyone to verify when and where sightings were reported. The bottom line is, I did not know the Project Blue Book stuff was public now, but hey, go check that stuff out. The bottom line is, there is absolutely no correlation between the times and places of UFO reports and U-2 flights, he wrote. Like, yeah, we did test flights over here, and okay, what the hell is this thing over here in the sky, you know, on the opposite side of the country? U-2 doesn't fly that fast, neither does the SR-71. There's my watch. Blue Book Look. A similar view about the CIA assertion is held by UFO photo analyst Bruce McAbee, who analyzed data and concluded that the CIA's explanation is preposterous, quote unquote. The statistics do not bear out the claim that there was a large increase in sightings by any segment of the population, pilots and air traffic controllers included, once a U-2 aircraft started flying, McAbee wrote in a recent blog post. Schaefer also argues that the CIA's claim that the U-2 flights led to the creation of Project Blue Book does not hold water, because Blue Book predates the U-2 flights by several years. Other Air Force projects to investigate flying saucer sightings were created several years earlier still. Yeah, like, what was it, 48 when the Roswell thing happened, or 40-something. So probably around that time, maybe a little bit earlier. I think that's actually in the World War II when they started that. The U-2 is still flying all these years later, despite advances in robotic aircraft tech that have led to the development of surveillance UAVs, such as United States Global Hawk, also Predators, Reavers, anything else, Herons, I guess, is the Israeli one. Leonard David has been reporting on this space. So that's just talking about the author, which I don't really care about reading. So that's very interesting. Oh, yeah, but all those UFOs, half of them were us. Or they were all us or whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we got people saying, oh, it was a saucer. It was flying low to the ground, and it was saucer shaped. Well, I'm pretty sure the U2 doesn't look like a saucer, and technically neither does the SR-71. Although 71 does look a lot more like that saucer, I guess. But at the same time, these aren't low-flying aircraft. They're high-flying reconnaissance aircraft. So, you know, that's... Yeah. So, you're full of crap, CIA. We know you are. It's the CIA. They've been lying this whole time anyways. That's what they do for a living, really, right? It's disinformation and denial. Not really denial, but just different disinformation. So, that's their job. And in corporate fairness news, thank you to WeOnly for this one. BlackBerry wants to legally force competitors to support BB10, or the BlackBerry 10 operating system. BlackBerry CEO John Chen has published an open letter, click on the link there, to US President Obama on net neutrality. Interestingly enough, he conflates net neutrality with what he calls content or application neutrality, unquote, at the beginning of the letter. It's a bit unclear what he means by this, but later one, man, why, it's just like the third freaking news story I've put up here that's got spelling errors, and they're all from different sources. But later on, correction there, all pieces of his puzzle fall into place. Here's a quotation from here, from the letter, I guess. Unfortunately, not all content and applications providers have embraced openness and neutrality. Unlike BlackBerry, which allows iPhone users to download and use our BBM, BlackBerry Messenger service, Apple does not allow BlackBerry or Android users to download Apple's iMessage messaging service. Netflix, which has forcefully advocated for carrier neutrality, has discriminated against BlackBerry customers by refusing to make its streaming movie service available to them. Many other applications providers similarly offered service only to iPhone and Android users. Many other applications providers or app providers similarly offer service only to iPhone and Android users. This dynamic has created a two-tiered wireless broadband ecosystem in which iPhone and Android users are able to access far more content and applications than customers using devices running other operating systems. These are precisely the sort of discriminatory practices that neutrality advocates have criticized at the carrier level. Therefore, neutrality must be mandated at the application and content layer if we truly want a free, open, and non-discriminatory internet. All wireless broadband customers must have the ability to access any lawful applications and content they choose, and applications content providers must be prohibited from discriminating based on a customer's mobile operating system. And then the remainder of this article says, I'm not entirely sure what to say about this. While I would personally welcome a world where companies are multi-platform by nature, it is completely preposterous to legally force them to do so. I could somewhat understand, but still oppose, a call for using open standards so third parties could, for example, create their own Hangouts, WhatsApp, iMessage, or Skype clients, but legally forcing companies to create applications for competing platforms? That's insane. Except for those with an agenda, we would all love to live in a world where companies like Apple, Google, and Microsoft, amongst others, use nothing but open standards and protocols, creating a level playing field for newcomers and small players. However, unless the closed nature of a protocol harms consumers, companies should be free to be as closed as they very well please. And I saw this morning, I was kind of skimming through it, and I used to be a huge, huge, huge advocate of BlackBerry. The first smartphone I had was a BlackBerry, and I had an Android, the first Android, the HTC Dream, I think it was, or whatever the hell they call them. And that was okay, but it was buggy as hell, so screw this, I went back to another BlackBerry. And I had the BlackBerry tablet that was the Playbook. Very awesome piece of equipment. But, the big thing is, with BlackBerry, you can't get a lot of apps, and that's been a huge problem. I like to say that's the reason why I left BlackBerry, but it's not. The reason I left BlackBerry is because, well, I guess that is one of the reasons, actually. But their customer service is shit. It really is. And they're trying to they're trying to do things, but they're doing it without customer input, really. And what they should be doing is taking customer input to make things better. And I understand that they are originally like a corporate, you know, their phones are designed for corporate situations and businesses and military and stuff. And that's what the big thing I liked about them is that they're secure by default, you know, more or less anyways. But that's the like, I just said, screw this, and that's why I'm on an Android phone now. It's because I can get more stuff for it, and it's better, and it's cross, you know, platform compatible and all that stuff. But at the same time, I can understand what BlackBerry is saying. Oh, we wanted to have this on this and blah, 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 blah. Why isn't people that, well, it's because your business model sucks ass, BlackBerry. That's why nobody is playing nicely with you or with you at all. It's because you are like, whatever. And customers will say something like, whatever. We don't care. We're going to do things the way we want to do it. Like, sorry, you went from a business line brand to a consumer line brand, and now you're going back into business brand, which is fine, but you've completely alienated your customer base, or a good chunk of your customer base anyways, especially with the playbook farce about, oh, we're gonna launch a new operating system. Yeah, a year and a half later, it still didn't come out, and still not out, so, and then they cancel it. So, bunch of idiots. But, I know, I understand where they're coming from. Oh, well, they should be cross-platform, but there should be, you shouldn't force that. I mean, let's say I'm working for Apple, as much as I hate Apple too, and technically I hate Google and Android, but whatever, you gotta put up with the evil one way or another. Let's say I'm a developer for Apple, or I'm Apple itself, I'm hiring developers, I'm gonna pay them a certain amount of money to develop a messaging app, iMessage or whatever. I'm gonna develop for this. Okay, and what's the next one that's, okay, well, we'll get to Android or whatever. Maybe. Or something. Is iMessage even on Android? I'm not sure. Has it been seen this article? I'm not sure. I don't really care. I wouldn't use it anyways. But I'm gonna develop this messaging application for Apple. I'm like, okay, well, maybe we should give this to somebody else. Like, Android's been asking for it and stuff. Everybody has an Android, knows people that run an iPhone. So, let's give them cross-compatibility. And so, okay, yeah, we'll do that. Okay, what about BlackBerry? Well, I don't know. There's not a lot of reason. It's extra coding that you'd have to do for a different operating system. As far as I understand it, you'd have to recode everything, or port it, or whatever. And it's just extra time and extra money. Why would they do that? Right? And again, BlackBerry is essentially... I don't know. It's on its death throes. It's been on its death throes for... since at least 2011, 2012, when everything really started diving and stuff. So maybe even earlier than that, 2008, 2009 was their best years, I believe, stock-wise. Now they're down to like $35 or $13 or something like that on the stocks. The only thing keeping them running is their enterprise stuff, really, and their government contracts, and that's fine. I think that should be kept going, but... like, why as a company or whatever, or as a developer, why would I develop something for a product that not a lot of people are going to use anyways? Like, the amount of people that run in BlackBerrys now, it's slim to none. It's slim to none. I'm not even using it, and I was a big BlackBerry advocate, but no, not anymore. So, I'm not advocating anybody anymore. You could all kiss my ass. So, yeah, I don't know. BlackBerry, you kind of screwed up. So that's all I gotta say on that one. And the last article we have today is in spacecraft news. Thank you to Exec for this one. Virgin Galactic's next spaceship 2 may be ready soon. And it's a video, so I'm guessing there's a video in there somewhere. Although I don't have one on my page, so maybe I have that blocked or something. Anyways, the private spaceflight company Virgin Galactic's second spaceship 2, that's the name of it, spaceship 2, is really starting to come together, just a few months after the first one broke apart during a tragic test flight accident. In a new video, in a new video showing the next spaceship 2, click on the link there, Virgin Galactic officials and engineers building the commercial space liner provided a revealing look behind the scenes of the space tourism project and reiterated their resolve to making private space travel a reality in the wake of last year's test flight tragedy. And as we all know, the first spaceship 2 crashed, click on the link there, on October 31st during its fourth rocket-powered flight test, killing co-pilot Michael Aylesbury and injuring pilot Peter Siebold. The suborbital space plane's feathering reentry system deployed earlier than it should have, say officials with the NTSB, who are continuing to investigate the accident. Virgin Galactic remains committed to getting Spaceship 2 up and running, and the second vehicle may be ready to go soon. Just click on a link there for an infographic on how the Spaceship 2 works. And there's a picture there of it on the construction. Now we're at a point where you... Okay, gotta read that again. Now we're at a point where you look at it and it looks like a spaceship, says Jonathan Ritchie, Spaceship 2 program manager at the spaceship company. The Virgin Group owns firm that designs and builds a vehicle in Mojave, California. The spaceship company decided to start building the second space plane in January 2012 and has made a great deal of progress in the 3 years since, Ritchie added. We've got all the big major pieces together, Ritchie said in the Spaceship 2 construction video released by Virgin Galactic last week. It's kind of like closing a box when you're satisfied with everything inside, and we're at that point. We've built the structure, we've packed it full of systems components, and now we're ready to tie the bow around it. The next big steps will include actions like painting the vehicle and checking out its avionics and other systems, Ritchie said. But the new Spaceship 2 may be grounded for a while, even after it's ready to fly. It may take the NTSB a year to finish its investigation, and then Virgin Galactic must convince FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, that it has satisfactorily addressed any problems identified before receiving a license for another test flight. I wouldn't be surprised if the next flight is pushed off a year or more. Random train. Scott Hubbard, director of the Stanford Center of Excellence for Commercial Space Transport at Stanford University, told Space.com shortly after the accident. The two-pilot, six-passenger Spaceship 2 is designed to be carried to an altitude of 50,000 feet, that's 15,000 meters or 15 kilometers, or so by an airplane called White Knight 2. At that point, that train is really freaking loud. That's random, sorry guys. At that point, Spaceship 2 is released and blasts itself upward with its onboard rocket engine. The vehicle has turned on its engine during four separate flight tests, but has not yet made it to orbital space. When commercial operations begin, customers can expect to experience a few minutes of weightlessness, as well as get a great view of Earth against the blackness of space, Virgin Galactic representatives say. Hundreds of people have put down deposits to reserve a seat aboard the vehicle. Tickets currently sell for $250,000, which actually is not too bad. So, very, very interesting. I really hope they get clearance from the FAA and the NTSB stuff gets cleared up and all that stuff. That'd be really, really awesome. Because they need to keep this going. We need to have commercial spaceflight. We really do. Spaceflight is awesome. So I'm going to take another drink here. Oh, it's really dry today. Okay. And into the daily hack. Today, we have one daily hack from the exec, and it's Proton Mail. This is a bit of a weird website, so what I am seeing here, it is, what is this here? It was an Indiegogo, they had an Indiegogo campaign, and they raised $550,492, and I guess it is a secure email system. And you can create accounts and all that stuff. I'm just going to go through off the points that I have here. Swiss-based, Proton Mail is incorporated in Switzerland, and our servers are located in Switzerland. We are outside of U.S. and European Union jurisdiction, and user data is protected by strict Swiss data protection laws. Zero access, we can't read your data. Because of our end-to-end encryption, your data is already encrypted by the time it reaches our servers. We cannot decrypt your encrypted messages, and as a result, we cannot share them with third parties. Ease of use. Encryption without the headache, backward compatible. Proton Mail works out of any modern web browser. There's nothing to install. So it's just like Gmail on the computer, really, or Hotmail on the computer, or whatever. We are also backwards compatible with other email providers, so you can continue sending and receiving emails from friends who are not using Proton Mail, because it's email, so yeah. Forever free, available for everyone. We believe privacy is a fundamental human right and should be available for everyone. That's why we offer multi-tiered pricing, including a free version that anyone can use. Let's bring privacy back to the people. Stay anonymous, we don't track our users, and we do not keep permanent logs or require any personal information to sign up. We even accept anonymous payment methods, such as Bitcoin, so even paid users have their privacy rights protected and cross-platform, mobile and tablet friendly. Proton Mail works on all devices, including desktops, laptops, tablets, and smartphones. It's as simple as visiting our site and logging in. There are no plugins or apps to install. Simply use your favorite web browser. And there's a link there for more security features, which I'm not going to read. It's okay. SSL secure connections, hardware level security, open source cryptography, self-destructing messages. With Proton Mail, emails are no longer permanent. You can set an optional expiration time on Proton Mail's encrypted emails, so they will be automatically deleted from the recipient's inbox once they have expired. This works for both emails sent to other Proton Mail users and encrypted emails sent to outside email addresses. Similar to Snapchat in a way, we've added a way for you to have even more ephemeral communication. So, yeah, there's a whole other thing there, so click on that for more information, I guess. Our story, Proton Mail, was founded in summer 2013 by a scientist who met at CERN and wanted more secure private internet, blah, 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 blah. Three guys there. System architect, front-end developer, and back-end developer. And it just talks about the design of it, and there's pictures there you can click on. It's pretty much like a black and white, a nice subdued version of Gmail. From what I can see here, it looks pretty similar. I'm not clicking on pictures to zoom into them, but you know, and it's contact links at the bottom there too. So it's very, very cool. I'm gonna check that out there maybe, I think. So I think you should too, everybody. It's in beta right now, I guess, too. So check it out. That seems pretty cool, actually, because you know, Gmail and Hotmail and Yahoo Mail and anything else, mail is pretty much evil, and they sell your data. And in Rec Media, we have the SpaceX Falcon 9 crashed. Falcon 9 is the reusable launcher that SpaceX is developing or has been developing, and they tried landing it on the, an old barge that they had converted out in the middle of the ocean, and it failed. And they said, oh, it's not that bad. The barge is still mostly intact, and some equipment was damaged or destroyed, and blah, 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 blah. Well, it made it seem like it wasn't that crazy, I guess. But anyways, just click on that link there, and they'll take you to some pictures and they'll show you the video of it crashing. Yeah, it wasn't that bad, I guess, for a rocket crash. Yeah, it was a big explosion, but it's actually kind of cool. But check it out. But that's all we have for you today. But don't worry, we'll be back. Well, I don't know if it'll be next week, or maybe it will. I'll try, but we'll be back sometime to make sure that you get the news that you need to survive. This has been a free podcast brought to you by the Wogs Who Care. If you cannot donate to the show, please distribute. But if you can donate, please do so by clicking on the Donate tab on the Rant Media website, as well as by donating to Red Octagon Studios, who so graciously, as opposed to my own speaking, will so graciously host all the episodes for Newsreel. Yeah. So donate to them too. Thank you to the Army of the Flying Monkeys and their assistance in gathering data. If you have information, music, or comments that you'd like to send, you can reach us at newsreel2@gmail.com, or you can send us the information through the website at newsreel.ca. And even though there may or may not be a hiatus here for the next few months, I'm going to keep trying to put out episodes whenever I can, wherever I can. Please keep sending stuff in, just in case, right? Because that gives us something to work with. It gives me something to work with, I guess. If you like the music in the background, be sure to check out Rant Radio Industrial, because all my hard drives are packed up, so I don't have anything to put in for music. We'll be fading out now with a track from Patient Zero called You Spin Me Around. And that is from, I don't know what album that's from. I think that's from the DLC Sides album that he put out. So, check that out. Remember, everyone, we will never defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.
right round, round, sounder. You spin me right round, baby, right round. Like a record, baby, right round, round, round.